It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farad. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up later, we'll hear why the mortality rate for white women in the United States is actually getting worse over time.
First, a new investigation out this week from ProPublica takes a look at software used across the country to predict future criminal acts. These risk assessments are becoming increasingly common in courtrooms across the nation and are used for a variety of purposes, but is there bias built into these programs?
ProPublica's investigation, which looked at thousands of risk scores of individuals who were previously arrested, found that the formula was particularly likely to falsely flag black defendants as future criminals, wrongly labeling this way at almost twice the rate as white defendants. So what's behind that? What are the implications as more people in the criminal justice system rely on these assessments?
Here with us now is Julia Angwin, senior reporter at ProPublica. Julia, thank you for joining us.
It's great to be here.
So you begin your piece with the story of two people who committed theft, but they did so in very different circumstances. Can you tell us a bit of their stories and how they ended up very differently?
Sure. So we tell the story of a young woman who's 18 years old, Brisha Borden. She and her friend were running late and saw a kid's bicycle and a Razor scooter in a neighbor's yard, grabbed it, tried to ride them, realized they were too small, the bikes were too small, and as the mom came out and said, "Those are my kids' bikes," they gave them back. However, a neighbor had already called the police, so the two girls were arrested and spent two nights in jail and were booked and given an assessment of whether they were going to be high risk of future crime. And Brisha got a rating of high risk. I compared her case to a pretty hardened criminal who stole $80 worth of tools from Home Depot. It was his, he'd been in prison for 5 years for armed robbery, and he had three armed robberies on his record. He went in for his shoplifting Home Depot charge, and which was also a petty theft charge, and he was given a rating of low risk. And the idea of these risk scores is it was going to predict whether they committed future crimes. And the scores were 100% wrong. Brisha, who is African-American, did not commit any future crimes, although she was rated high risk. And Vernon Prater, who is white, did go on to commit future crimes despite being rated low risk.
And you're right that these risk assessment tools, these algorithms, have been taken up in lots of states around the country, including Wisconsin. Originally, what was their purpose? How were they supposed to be used?
Well, the intention behind the use of risk assessment tools is actually very well-intentioned. The idea is that humans and our criminal justice system have been biased racially for a while, and that if we were to use more objective measures of risk, we might take some of that bias out of the system. So what's happened is that all sorts of states are using different tools. Wisconsin is using the tool that I wrote about called Compass, and they use it throughout the prison system, and particularly at sentencing. And the idea is the judge gets a report when they're making the decision on a sentence of whether this person is a high risk to the community for future reoffense. And they take that into consideration when they decide whether maybe to do incarceration or probation or parole.
Now, originally, it sounds as though, as you said, that was the original intent. But what are you seeing about how these tools are being used today, especially in sentencing?
Well, so unfortunately, what we saw when we did our analysis is that the tools are not unbiased. They do, at twice the rate, give blacks a high risk score that is unjustified. We analyzed the future criminality of 7,000 people for 2 years after they were scored, and so in those 2 years, which is the common measure for recidivism, they didn't go on to reoffend, and whites were twice as likely to get a low-risk score that was unjustified, meaning they went on to reoffend in the next 2 years. And so, weirdly, the overall accuracy of the algorithm is about 61%, meaning, you know, it's a little better than a coin toss. But the way that it fails is different by race, and that's something that I think we all need to think about when adopting such tools.
So ProPublica looked at this on your own. This has been suggested as maybe this could be a problem before, but you were the first people to dig deep into it. Why do you think it hasn't been flagged as having racial bias before?
Well, it was really hard to prove this racial bias. We've been working on this for more than a year, so I can see why it's been hard for people to do this. Also, risk assessment scores are really new. They have really burst onto the scene, and for instance, the youth in sentencing is really something that's just been taking off in the past couple years. We were inspired to do this work when Attorney General Holder at the time was Attorney General in 2014, asked for an independent assessment to be done of whether there was racial bias in these risk assessment scores at sentencing. No one did it, so we took up the banner and gave it a shot.
We're talking with Julia Angwin right now from ProPublica, talking about a new report about risk assessment tools and possible racial bias. That's what ProPublica found. And what did the makers of these tools say when they saw your research?
So the maker of the tool said that they disputed our analysis and that we had reached the wrong conclusions. However, they did not really provide anything that made us doubt our work. We asked them repeatedly to provide some specific feedback about things they thought were wrong, and we didn't get that from them. I'm hopeful that maybe they will still come forward with something that will allow us to understand their criticism, but at the moment, what I really know is that they dispute our analysis. And we've had some conversations about what they dispute, and we feel like all of those questions we've answered.
It sounds as though there is some evidence that these risk assessment tools may keep people out of jail and do more what they're designed to do. You talk about Virginia. So is there sort of a mixed case to be made about this?
I think that's right. The way risk assessment tools are meant to be used is that a judge would look at it and say, high risk means actually that you have a lot of needs. You need maybe drug treatment, or you need some cognitive behavioral therapy or mental health counseling, or you need somebody to help you find a job and vocational training. And that's how they were designed to be used. But what we have seen in particular in two cases in Wisconsin where judges looked at the score and said, you're high risk, I'm increasing your sentence in prison, right? So the problem is that it can be designed for this good use, but it looks as though a judge, when they're holding something in front of them that says this person is likely to be a violent criminal, are reluctant to release them to community. And it's worth pointing out that the violence prediction that we found in this was particularly bad. It was only right about violent crime 20% of the time.
And Julia, just in a couple moments here, what would you say you hope from this data going forward? How do you hope it's used?
I hope that people will take a look at the tools they're using, the risk assessment tools, and now analyze them for racial bias. So many of these tools haven't been checked for racial bias, and it would just be good for everybody to look at that when they're going to use the tool for something as important as somebody's liberty.
Julia, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Julia Angwin, senior reporter at ProPublica.
Coming up, we'll hear why the mortality rate for white women in the United States is getting worse over time. First, a look at some of the latest news.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, those of us who call Wisconsin home know that all seasons and landscapes have their own charms and appeal. Our guest poet talks about cultivating a sense of wonder in Wisconsin's nature and farmland.
First, thanks to many medical advances, better access to healthy food and safer homes and workplaces, people in the United States are living longer. But one group has seen declining life expectancy rates for several decades, middle-aged white people and white women in particular.
Dr. Patrick Remington joins us now for a look at why this is happening. He's a professor and associate dean in the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. He's also a member of the Wisconsin Medical Society's Board of Directors. Dr. Remington, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be here. Thanks.
Well, let's talk these trends, mortality trends. Usually we like to see them obviously going down. And big picture in the United States, that's still the case, right? Mortality trends for most groups are in a general downward direction. Is that right?
Yeah, and that's been a good thing. When you look at death rates, not just the number of deaths, but the rate, number of deaths per unit population, we have seen steady declines at all ages, except obviously the very oldest ages.
So that's what makes this story so strange. White women in particular, their death rate is going up.
Yeah, well, what the authors did, Case and Deaton, did in their study was to slice and dice the mortality data in many, many different sections, not just for the United States, but by age group, and then also by social and economic status, by race. And when they got done, they noticed that the general trends that we see with declining death rates were not the case in people 45 to 54 years of age, that middle age group, in particular whites. not so much a minority population. So it's really an exception to the general trend of improving life expectancy and declining death rates.
Now, before we get into that increase in the death rate for that particular group, big picture, white people tend to live longer. They have lower death rates at that middle age than minority communities. Is that right?
Almost at every age except the very oldest ages, whites have longer life expectancy, lower death rates than blacks and Native Americans. Hispanics and Asians, it depends on the age group and some of the issues of how race is classified. But in general, Native Americans and blacks have higher death rates and lower life expectancy compared to whites.
But we're seeing improvement in those other categories and backsliding among these, like what we could call middle-aged white women in particular. Is that right?
Yeah. Again, it's what men and women, but middle-aged whites, the mortality rate is going up. Again, the mortality rate or the death rate among minority populations is much higher in that age group.
Right.
But it's seeing a progressive decline, an improvement in the death rate, unlike what we're seeing in white middle-aged men and women.
So that's alarming. Let's start looking at the reasons for this increase in the death rate for middle-aged white men and women. A lot of the focus in the reporting has been on women, but both. What kind of factors are doing this in the midst of what I thought was generally improving health in this country?
Well, in general, death rates are fairly low in the middle age. When you get to be 65 or 75 years of age, death rates increase, certainly by life expectancy. By definition, half of people in that cohort have died. But 45 to 54, we don't see very many deaths occurring. So an increase in relatively uncommon causes of death can be noticeable. And what's been seen is a dramatic increase in three different types of causes of death. One is suicide, two is accidental poisonings, and three is liver disease. And if you think about those three causes of death, although they're really pretty different, they have underlying similarities in that they result from self-destructive behaviors, opioid use and addiction, alcohol abuse, and also depression and using lethal means to commit suicide.
I want to specify accidental poisonings. Would that include some kind of overdose or combination of medications and alcohol?
Yeah, if someone dies as a result of poisoning from an opioid or heroin, for example, then it's up to the coroner to decide the intent. If a person did it intentionally, then it would be counted as a suicide. If they did it accidentally, then it would be counted as an accidental poisoning.
I want to make sure I'm hearing you right. Suicide, these accidental poisonings, including overdoses and liver disease, these are happening with enough prevalence to turn that downward trend in mortality to an upward trend for these middle-aged white people.
That's correct. And when you look at the trends, not just in minority populations, but across the world, this is an age group that generally has seen improving death rates. We're able to diagnose and treat chronic diseases better. There are effective medications to help treat depression. Many of the accidental deaths from car crashes have been going down. Again, these results come from a fairly long time ago. They come from trends that began in the late 1990s until almost a decade ago. So we haven't seen the impact of relatively recent changes. For example, the Affordable Care Act was implemented after this study was completed.
But we're hearing a lot lately about opioid addiction as a growing problem now. It sounds like if these are older, this is older data, this is becoming a problem 10 years ago or more.
Well, there's always a lag between a problem that first becomes apparent by clinicians who are treating people one by one and the point where the general public becomes aware of it. And certainly people in the substance abuse field and physicians treating these patients. And in fact, coroners have been seeing this for decades. But it takes a long time, almost like the obesity epidemic, which really began almost two decades ago. It takes sometimes years, sometimes even decades, for the public conscience to really be fully aware of it.
Talking to Patrick Remington from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health about mortality rates on the rise from middle-age white men and women. So you mentioned a common theme in these causes, a suicide, accidental poisoning, including overdose, liver disease, lifestyle, and maybe a difficult life. This may be one of those cases we've talked about before where health isn't just about what we eat, our medicine, our healthcare. It's about something else in our lives. Is there something socioeconomically going on that's driving all this?
Well, there's no question that that's the case. We know that health is not just about healthcare. In fact, we estimate that really a minority, a small portion of the health of a person or of a community is related to the quality of your health care or your ability to access it, your lifestyle, your behaviors that you engage in, but also your social and economic status, your ability to have a job and get a good education. So those factors are kind of the foundation of a healthy community and obviously are the root causes of some of the trends we're seeing today.
As I understand it, a lot of the increase in mortality for middle-aged white men and women is happening in rural areas, more so than urban areas. Is that right? And if so, why?
Well, it is. In fact, just 30 minutes ago, I came from a meeting with researchers where we're beginning to explore these causes of death, but also thinking about the places where these causes of death are increasing. And certainly rural America is predominantly white and affected disproportionately by unemployment. We have seen, compared to urban areas, rural communities over the last decade have not seen the declines overall in premature death rates. So we know there are challenges in rural areas, but we really don't understand which rural areas, whether it's true across the nation or in certain regions of the country. So this study by Case and Deaton has really stimulated a lot of further analysis of the data that we have available.
How about healthcare access and mental health care access, where even if you might have a hard time getting it in a city, you're geographically maybe not very far from a source of service, where in a rural area, there might be one provider in a county in some cases, especially for mental health care. How big a factor is that?
It's an incredibly big factor. Remember, again, that this study was during a period when there were caps on mental health services, that a person with mental illness might not have access to a provider, or if they did, the amount of insurance that would pay for it was capped. Also, this is before the Affordable Care Act, when 50 or 60 million people were without insurance or couldn't afford insurance. So those changes, those good changes that we've made, eliminating the mental health cap and providing insurance to people regardless of ability to pay, those hopefully will begin to turn the tide on this trend. And hopefully we're seeing historical trends that now are going in the other direction.
If those are happening now, we probably won't be able to measure them for 5-10 years. Is that right?
I would say that we should be able to begin to see some of the these trends. Unlike many chronic diseases like lung cancer or heart disease that develop over years and decades, accidental poisonings should be able to be addressed within days or weeks of an intervention. So our hope is that as the public begins to talk about this, that interventions that are available today and that work that have been proven to work can actually be reaching the people who need them.
We've been talking big picture, the data, the numbers. As a public health researcher, do you think it's important that someone is trying to find out the individual stories of the people who are making up these statistics?
Well, there's no question. I was quoted in a newspaper article nationally on this story, and I've gotten phone calls from people who've been affected by unemployment, by mental illness, and are feeling these health effects. So it is absolutely a story that not only comes across from looking at the data, but comes across community by community. And really, it's the collective sum of individual stories that we're talking about. But you don't have to go very far to hear from somebody who's had a family member affected by substance abuse or depression or suicide.
This new data that we started talking about, recent data, is this something that public health officials, public health researchers were already working on, or is this something that this is kind of a new wake-up call that's motivating us to try to tackle these problems?
I find it intriguing that we have all this data and we have federal and state agencies in charge of collecting and consolidating the data. But I think it was a wake-up call. These investigators were very clever to slice the data into these subgroups, and probably driven by a hypothesis that with ailing economy and the recession, that there may be a subset of the population particularly affected. So I think it's a good example of sort of the continual examination of the population health data that combined with hearing individual stories. So I do think it's a wake-up call. It's not just an anecdotal case here and there. This is a pattern that has developed over decades and will take concerted effort to turn the other direction.
Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Patrick Remington is a professor and associate dean in the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. He joins us to talk about why middle-aged white people, white women in particular, are seeing their mortality rates going up, their life expectancy going down, and what can be done to turn that trend around.
Coming up after the news, with forests, prairies, lakes, and more, Wisconsin landscapes, each of their own particular beauty, we talk with a poet about cultivating a sense of wonder. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farah. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll hear from singer-songwriter Josh Ritter. He's performing at Milwaukee's Pabst Theater tonight.
First, there's something special about the first days and weeks when temperatures warm up, birds are migrating, and everything seems to be lush and green.
That feeling of appreciation for the new season reminded us of a conversation we had with former Wisconsin poet laureate Max Garland. It's no secret that Wisconsin's a beautiful state. We've got lakes and bluffs and forests and farm fields. But is there something deeper there, maybe something spiritual or inspirational?
Garland thinks so. In an essay for the Reedsburg Fermentation Festival newsletter, he talked about how Wisconsin farmlands and natural areas can be a source of wonder, even artistic inspiration. He got to thinking about this idea during a bike ride that was part of that festival in the rolling hills around Reedsburg. So I began by asking him what he saw there that sparked these thoughts.
Well, it was hard not to be taken aback or impressed. Let's see, what did I see? I saw an operatic soprano singing on the hillside with a dress made out of corn stalks and being accompanied by a piano. I saw a 6600 John Deere that it had the metal panels taken out and replaced with stained glass. I saw a hillside in which there were dozens and dozens of kites shaped and spotted like Holsteins. And so all in all, it was a pretty remarkable, and that's not mentioning how beautiful the landscape from Reedsburg to Lime Rock and Ironton actually is on its own, but this idea of putting art out in the already beautiful landscape, that's what sort of triggered my thinking about this sort of idea of cultivating wonder.
And this isn't anything new. You wrote the piece near the Man Mound in Reedsburg. Humans have a long history of combining art and Wisconsin's outdoors.
Right. I mean, at first one might think, well, this is an unusual thing. There's art in the countryside, and this festival every October is something that, might be interesting to drive or stop and look at. However, the point I try to make in the essay is that people have, in the rural areas of Wisconsin, have been making art as long as they've been here. Our great-great-grandmothers spent those long winter nights making quilts that weren't just useful, but they were beautiful. Even before in the early days of the European settling, it was hard work in those lumber camps, but every one of them had a fiddler. So there was an understanding that art and beauty and wonder were necessary, even when the bare necessities were barely taken care of. But finally, the point I make is that for thousands of years, drums, chants, stories, songs, poems, and all of this sort of exemplified for one of the most amazing works of art, rural art, which is a 214-foot human-shaped effigy mound just outside of Baraboo that's about 1,000 years old. And that to me was, I was thinking about, well, this idea of fashioning something that's amazing and that is a work of art into the countryside, even into the land itself, goes back further than we really have memory of. And the day that I sat there by the man mound, this huge effigy mound, and wrote the essay, it was covered with thousands and thousands of violets, which coincidentally is Wisconsin's state flower.
Now, when you are out there looking at the landscape, maybe getting your own inspiration, do you feel like you're communing with the people who built that mound and the people who made those quilts?
I can't even, you know, I can't presume to know what the people, we don't even know for sure. Probably the late woodland people, maybe 1,000 years ago, but there's so much that we don't know. But even an amateur such as myself, I can commune in this way. Here is a human shape. It might be a spirit, it might be a divine figure, and it's made out of earth. And every ounce of earth, every handful of earth in it is made out of living organisms. And so am I. And so at least, you know, I'm not going to pretend to be an anthropologist or archaeologist, but I can figure that much out.
Let's bring in a caller at 800-642-1234. We've got Ariel in Delafield. Ariel, hi.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I love Wisconsin. I am inspired daily by just the beautiful scenery that I see while bicycling around or driving around in my area, which is the Southern Tenebrane State Forest.
And what is it? How does it inspire you? How does it make you feel?
It just makes me feel happy. I see cranes in the fields or fawns when I pull into my subdivision, or just the sunbeams shooting through the twilight sun as it goes through the white pines. Like, it's just gorgeous, and it makes me feel peaceful and calm and just full of beauty. And I think that when people take the moment to look at that sun ray as it goes through the trees, or feel the cool air as you go into the forest further, like when you take those moments of reflection, of calmness, of really a spiritual cleansing, that's really what's happening to you. And I think that helps you be just better, happier.
Ariel, thank you so much for that call. Max, I don't know if Ariel is a poet, but her description of the landscape came out kind of poetical. Does it kind of naturally flow?
It really did. It took two or three things are interesting about that. One is what she mentioned, the cranes, the deer, the white pines, all of these things that we really identify with Wisconsin, were preserved at some point. They were almost completely eliminated. The town where I am right now, is the reason that it's here in the way it is because of white pines, and they were almost all cut down in an amazingly short time. But people stopped from the brink. They realized what she realized, you know, to some extent in the nick of time. And now we understand that we work and we are a part of that. We have to manage it. You know, we have to be, if we want it to continue, we have to pass it on if we want it to keep coming. And another thing she talked about stopping.
Yeah.
we all recognize that when we fly across the country or we fly to another country, we become disoriented. We don't know where we are. We can't eat right. We can't sleep right. We're not experiencing things, and we call that jet lag. It's my contention that every time you drive across the state, which I've driven 17,000 to 18,000 miles across it in the last year and a half, you have a sort of mini jet lag. You have to wait until you slow down enough to figure out where you are, and you can see and hear and feel and smell and really get back onto human time. And I rode my bike here, and I was watching hundreds and hundreds of cars at what, you know, what we call rush hour here in Eau Claire. And I was thinking, we're in the state so often. And when we're in the state, what we don't realize is that the land itself is actually moving. Once we stop and look at the shape of the hills and the shape of the river and the streams, we realize that, oh, it's moving too. It's not a static thing. It's not inert. And once we realize, you know, pick up a handful of dirt and we realize, oh, and this is not inert. This is full of more living organisms than there are people on Earth. And once you take that time and you're slowing down, then suddenly the idea of the wonder of where you are and what your relationship to that place is begins to sort of kick in.
Do we take it for granted, this treasure we have?
Yes, we take it for granted because we are bombarded by sales pitch and propaganda and all sorts of things that cause us to want to hustle and move from place to place. We think the greatest sin is not being busy. And once you do slow down and you think, oh, yes, this land is moving. It always was. Oh, this land is not dead. It's full of living organisms. I'm holding in my hand billions of them. And then you realize that the hand itself of 27 bones is also, it also contains many living organisms, microbes, bacteria. And so that relationship to that place really takes you back to what I think might have been one of the messages of the people who, over the course of months, if not years, built the Man Mound, which is, this is our home. We are made of this.
Max, before we get back to our callers, we've been talking a lot about the visual. You also write a little bit about the soundscape of the places you're talking about. What do you listen for there?
It takes a while if you're traveling across the interstate and to get that roar out of your, you know, the vibration and the roar out of your ears to start hearing and differentiating between the things that you're hearing. I was leading a group of students a few years ago, and we were just doing an orientation, and I was pointing out, well, that's a white pine, that's a tamarack, that's an elm tree, it's probably doomed, that's a crow, and I was doing these things, and this girl said she thought she had made a mistake. She thought, I thought I signed up for an English class, and here I was, you know, telling her what the sounds of these birds were and all that. And she said, how do you know all this? And I said, well, I live here. I mean, it seemed like the kind of thing that you should know if you live in a place, what things sound like, the names of things, the differences between trees. For many, many thousands of years, it's been necessary to know that in order to survive. And even though we may think it's not necessary, there is still something about understanding who we are and our relationship to the world in which we live that I think still makes it necessary to pay attention to the place we live and the parts of that, the sounds, the sights, the smells, the shape of the land.
That's Wisconsin poet Max Garland talking about Wisconsin's rural and natural landscapes and how they can cultivate a sense of wonder in all of us and inspire us artistically, too.
And we'd love to hear from you on this. How are you inspired by the landscape around you? Do you feel a sense of wonder when you look up over the bluff or the lake in your community? And what is it specifically about Wisconsin that inspires these feelings? Head on over to the Central Time Facebook page and let us know.
We'll get to the second part of our conversation with Max Garland in just a moment. First, a look at some of the latest news with the WPR News Department. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our look back at our conversation with Wisconsin's former poet laureate, Max Garland. Do you find yourself being inspired or maybe even entranced by Wisconsin's landscapes? Do you make time in your life to pause and just soak in your surroundings? And how do you describe those feelings to someone who's not from Wisconsin? Head over to the Central Time Facebook page and leave us a comment while you're there.
We'll go now to Kurt on the line in Wauwatosa. Kurt, hi.
How you doing? Thanks for taking my call. I just chimed into this program on my way home from work here, and I felt compelled to call right away. One of the things that really inspires me about Wisconsin is the ancient landscape that is so readily overlooked by many people that are not aware of the ancient landscape that's going around us, and in particular, the Abugee Mound landscape of Wisconsin. It's been a source of inspiration for me since I was a small boy, and it's one of the main reasons why I head out and spend time in the, especially a lot of the rural areas of Wisconsin. I am an archaeologist by trade, and one of the things that is really unique about Wisconsin is this ancient effigy mound culture that we have, and there are literally thousands of ancient Indian mounds all over the state that that are being protected by various groups of people and inspired people even 1,000 years later.
Kurt, thank you so much for sharing that. We talked about one of the mounds, Max, but I like the way you put it, part of our ancient landscape that we still walk among here in Wisconsin.
I think that's true, and whenever we talk about the heritage of art, we have to remember that it's been going on here for thousands of years, 10 to 12,000 years. This the confluence of the rivers where I am right now, people taught other people how to make things and how to do things and how to sing things and how to remember things, and it's a long tradition, and it's still a part of our tradition as well.
Thanks a lot for the call. We'll go now to Nathan with us in Platteville. Nathan, hi.
Hi. One of the things that I always thought was amazing about Wisconsin was there's like two different types of land here. And I grew up in Platteville and Dodgeville and just seeing the rolling hills all my life. And then when I got married, I went on a honeymoon to Minocqua. And just being surrounded by the forest and seeing the lake, it's like you have two different universes in one state, and you get to see the gorgeous rolling hills, or you can see it like as far into the horizon, and then you're up in the northern part where you're just surrounded by woods and you can feel nature's closer. And it's just traveling between those two really reminds you of the great difference Wisconsin holds and why it's such one of our greatest states.
Nathan, thank you so much. I'll see your hills and forests and raise you some bluffs and a winding Wisconsin River, too. There's so much diversity, Max.
And how about those dolomite cliffs on the southeast side of Door County with the caves and all of those things that have been carved away at for the last few million years, and the driftless area south of here where all of these the amazingly sinuous Kickapoo River. You can't believe how many times it turns. And so there's a lot of that.
Thanks a lot, Nathan, for sharing that. We'll go now to Willem in Colfax. Willem, hi.
Hi. I totally agree with what he says about the beauty of the land and just noticing all the different birds and the trees and the quality of living in this beautiful environment. I live in eastern Dunn County, close to western Chippewa County, but things are changing very quickly with industrial frac sand mining, and I don't think that, like, it worries me that what happened with all the white pines were clear cut, but those things grow back, but hills don't grow back, and our peace and quiet don't grow back, and it's close to where I live, and I'm not a person that objects to this because this is close to where I live. I didn't like it when it started over by Hoffman Hills.
Willem, thanks a lot for the call. Max, so you're in Eau Claire. This is going on in your neck of the woods. Is this a concern for you when you think about the future of the landscapes we talk about?
Well, I am glad that someone left the hills for us. I am glad that the river, though it's had its trials, still flows through here. And the point, I think, of what I was saying, slowing down, looking around you, recognizing what's around you, it gives you a sense of wonder, and that word is connected with awe, astonishment, amazement. And the upshot of that sense of wonder is that you want to preserve it. You want to pass it on. You don't want to take it and use it up. The river that I'm just talking about, that I crossed a few minutes ago and I'm going to cross a few more minutes, it still has a lesson for us, as those hills do, as that mound does. And the lesson that river has for us is, if you want to keep it coming, you have to pass it on. And that has to do with art, tradition, wisdom, education, and certainly has to do with the beauty of a place, because the beauty is part of the value of the place. It's part of what makes our life worth living.
Go back to our callers now with Paul in Laval. Paul, hi.
Hi, how's it going? I actually live right on the route of the Farmark Detour where you're taking your bicycle ride. Yeah, so you passed our little 10-acre farmette, and one thing I kind of noticed, I grew up in Southern Illinois, and I lived 25 years in Chicago. I think a lot of local people take for granted how beautiful this area really is and how lucky we are to be here. I mean, I've traveled extensively. I've been to Europe a number of times, you know, been around the Midwest, and there's no other place I'd rather live than where I live right here in Sauk County. And just wanted to kind of say that.
Paul, thank you so much for sharing that. And Max, can you leave us with some, I guess, art appreciation tips for enjoying the landscape that Paul was talking about?
Well, I think the last thing I would just say is that how art fits into this, whether it's something like the Fermentation Fest, whether it's any other of the exercises of art in the rural community, is that art reminds us of that connection. It reminds us of who we are and where we come from and what's at stake. And once you see that beauty, once you experience that beauty and feel the beauty that people have been talking about, then in the words of the great American poet William Stafford, who said, "I place my feet carefully in such a world." I think that's what we want to do.
That was Max Garland. He joined us to talk about the wonder and inspiration that's often brought on by Wisconsin's beautiful landscapes.
And we want to hear from you. Is there something about Wisconsin's natural beauty that makes you catch your breath? Something that you can't imagine living without, maybe? Well, maybe it's even inspired you to create art. We'd love to hear more about that and more on the Central Time Facebook page. Happy 75th birthday to music legend Bob Dylan. He was born on this day in 1941. His birth name, Robert Allen Zimmerman.
And he was born, and this was news to me, in Duluth, Minnesota. He was raised in Hibbing, Minnesota, so he was basically our neighbor here in Wisconsin until he moved to New York after dropping out of the University of Minnesota after his freshman year.
Last Monday marked the 50th anniversary of one of his biggest albums. It was called Blonde on Blonde, and it was released in the aftermath of the Electric controversy when many of his folk music fans turned against him for his use of electric instruments.
People were pretty angry at the time, but it seems like it all worked out.
So happy birthday to the big Bob Dylan and to his fans. And coming up, we're going to talk to musician Josh Ritter, often seen as one of Dylan's musical descendants. This is Central Time.